I pay homage to the Gautama, who moved by his compassion toward the holy Dharma to rid us of all distorted views. So today, so we'll finish the rest of the chapter one of the precious garland, and then I'll try to finish the middle stages of meditation. So we finished the 27th verse, which is on page 5 yesterday. Now next, 28th, the I exists, the mind exists, these are wrong as ultimates. So we innately, we have a sense of an I. So within that, there is a sense of an I, which is seen as if it is the governing, or it is the governor of the body and the mind, which is called the clinging to the self, which has some kind of a substantially self-sufficient existence. So here, what is actually happening is that the mind and the body are seen as the servant of the I, or the self. And within this view of self-sufficient, substantially existent I, there is a view where the view is in which sees which actually sees the self and as that kind of self-sufficient existence as having same kind of attribute to the aggregates, and then another one which does not see that kind of attribute. So within the latter, there is the innate the grasping as well. And then ultimately, what happens is things appear to have some independent existence. And just as they appear to us in that way, we also cling to that. And similarly, we have the sense of an I, which is independently existing, objectively existing. And so that kind of grasping at such a self is the subtlest form of grasping at a self. And that gives rise to subtler form of attachment and anger. And so this subtlest kind of negative emotion like attachment and anger is concomitant with or goes together with the grasping at true existence of self. So apart from the Prasangika Madhyamakas, who destroy all objectification in things, the other philosophical traditions, within Buddhism, even within the Madhyamaka tradition, actually consider that kind of independent or non-independent, the objective existence of a self as valid. And therefore, so the subtlest form of attachment and anger can go together with the grasping at true existence of a self. But clinging to a self, which is, as said earlier, the self-sufficiently, substantially existent I, and that grasping at such a self cannot go together with this subtlest form of grasping, but it is produced by or given rise to by that subtlest form of grasping at true existence. And so they do not have the same kind of apprehension of the object as well. So right from the sometime beginning less, we have this deep or subtle sense of an I, which is independently existent I. And whether such an I or self exists or not, we need to investigate. So in one of the texts, it is said that things do appear to us as if they have some objective independent existence. Whether such an existence is valid or not, we need to investigate into it. And so we have things that we can analyze. And therefore, there is an appearance aspect and then the reality aspect of things. So we need to go and look for that reality, what the reality exactly is, the final reality is. And then there is also a level of understanding things on a conventional level where we don't do any kind of analysis or into the things, just accepting the things as convention. So the I exists, the mind exists, these are the wrong as ultimates. So if the I or mind were to have any objective independent existence, then they should become clearer and clearer as we do a deeper and deeper analysis into them, but that's not the case, and therefore they are wrong as ultimates. For the two are not established by a thorough understanding of reality, just as it is. So what we need to confirm, try to bring up understanding is that things do not have any existence the way they appear to us. So because of this grasping, then what happens is we create karma, and that karma leaves its imprint on the consciousness, and then we take rebirth and goes through the rest of the chain. So these mind and body that we have, which are the results of karma and delusions, the mental and physical aggregates arise from the conception of I, which is false in fact. How could what is grown from a false seed be true? Having seen thus the... let's first say the blessing for the tea and bread. Verse number 29 finished.
请随着我一起念。 供养佛, 供养法, 供养僧, 供养一切众生, 愿断一切恶, 愿修一切善, 适度一切众生.
I make this offering to the Buddha, I make this offering to the Dharma, and I offer this to the Sangha, and I also make offer this to all sentient beings.
Mm.
Hence, having seen thus the aggregates are untrue, the conception of I is abandoned, and due to the abandonment of conception, the aggregates arise no more. Just as it is said that an image of one's false is one's face is seen depending on a mirror, but does not really exist as a face. So the conception of I exists dependent on the aggregates, but like the mirage on one's face, the I does not at all really exist. Just as without depending on a mirror, the image of one's face is not seen, so too the conception of I does not exist without depending on the aggregates. When So when you look into a mirror, you see your reflection, the image of yourself. So the reflection itself does not exist as one's face at all from its sight. But to us, even the mirror, the reflection appears as if it has some intrinsic existence. But if you search for that intrinsically existent thing, you will not find anything. As long as the aggregates are conceived, 35, so long thereby does the conception of I exist. Further, when the conception of I exists, there is action, and from it there is also birth. So just as I said yesterday, when the body and the mind appear to our mind, they appear as if they have some objective existence from their own side. So as long as there is this grasping, as long as you are not able to get rid of or refute such a way of existence, so long there is going to be this conception of self, of a person. So you will not be able to get undermine this grasping at a self of a person as well. As long as there is this grasping at a self of a phenomena, the aggregates. So in our philosophical text, within the compounded phenomena, there are three types of phenomena. The physical things, and then the mind or consciousness, and then there is what is known as the non-associated compositional factors. And then the lower schools also make difference between the fact that the person is designated, whereas the aggregates are substantially existence. And similarly, it is the case with time. So although they do say that a person is designated, but it's a rough understanding of designation. But such a way of understanding will not undermine grasping at a self of a person at all. So long as there is this grasping at a self of phenomena, the aggregates, you cannot get rid of or undermine the grasping at a self of a person. But when you actually demonstrate the selflessnesses, one first establishes the selflessness of persons, and then go into the establishment of the selflessness of phenomena, the aggregates. Whereas for some people, demonstrating the selflessness of phenomena is done first, and then they go into this establishing the self of a person, selflessness of a person, which is more powerful for them. For example, if you check the mind having no objective existence at all, no inherent existence of the mind at all, then it is more powerful to establish that the person designated on the basis of the mind does not also have any intrinsic existence. And therefore, what I So long as one accepts and asserts that there is from amongst the aggregates something called an I or a self, then there is a strong grasping of a self. So from our experience, we have the experience of the mind. Therefore, when you are able to feel the I or the self based on this consciousness, which is strong experience, and if you are able to establish that there is no the consciousness itself, the mind itself, which serves as the basis for the designation of the self, actually does not have any intrinsic existence at all, then that is a powerful, that serves as a powerful means to understand that, gain insight into the selflessness of a person as well. So, verse number 35. With these three pathways, mutually causing each other without a beginning, a middle, or end, this wheel of cyclic existence turns like a wheel of firebrand. So during the birth, afflicted birth, create the karmas, and also which are brought about by the afflictive emotions. And so since there is no beginning to the consciousness nor or the samsara, while we are undergoing one cycle of the 12 links of dependent origination, and even while going through this one cycle, we are creating more karmas, and that will throw us into more cycles of birth, death, aging, and sickness. And so it's endless like that. Because this wheel is not obtained from self, other, or from both in the past, present, and future, the conception of I is overcome, and thereby action and rebirth. Verse number 37. So, as it is taught in the Madhyamaka text, there is a law of causality. It is not that whatever things happen just as we wish, and therefore the causes give rise to their effects. And as long as something is an effect, it must depend on its cause, and therefore the realists say that things do because the effects arise from their respective causes, that they are not what we think or what we project, and therefore there is an objective independent existence. Whereas the Madhyamaka say that there is no true existence, just as you say, the realists, and because things are dependently originated. And so the reasoning of dependent origination is used differently by these schools. So when establishing emptiness, there is the establishing of and proving an emptiness through the tetralemma reasoning or logic. And then there are other reasonings also, such as the reasoning of lack of one and many. As it is said in the three principal aspects of the path, the one who has been able to destroy all objectification has entered the path pleasing the Buddhas. So first you bring up the understanding of the law of causality of within samsara and nirvana, that everything comes through causes and conditions. And then you gain the understanding of how things are merely designated. And because things are merely designated, they do not have any intrinsic inherent existence. And then you also bring up this understanding where the understanding of insight into emptiness, that things do not have, and that there's nothing to be asserted ultimately, and that things are causally dependent and arising, that they actually complement each other. And so you need to actually develop these understandings in a progressive manner, and first hearing the teachings and then trying to use those logic, and then try to ascertain reality through inferential cognition. And so, because this wheel is not obtained from self, other, or from both in the three times. So regarding the three times, we actually posit or accept things without doing any critical analysis into the things, but taking things conventionally. So to say that things are conventional, there are three criteria: that they are conventionally renowned, and that they other valid cognitions or understandings do not undermine the convention, and then it is that it is not also undermined by the ultimate analysis into things. And so we need to take things according to this kind of convention, but not the way, not according to the way they appear to our mind. In one of the seven Dalai Lama's writings, in the four mindfulnesses, at the crossroad of the six perceptions, there is this hazy, baseless existence. And this is deception. And so, because things appear as if they have some independent existence, so there's this duality, deception. So he says, do not consider this to be true, but place your mind in emptiness. Look at the nature of emptiness. And so, in order to stay on meditation, you need to develop single-pointed concentration. Stability of mind needs to be developed. And then the Dalai Lama, the seventh Dalai Lama, says that just as the vapor or the clouds dissipate in the autumn sky, likewise, all these appearances disappear within the insight into emptiness. And then, of course, you develop the five-tiered path. When you progress along the path, you develop the path of accumulation. And then when you enter into the path of preparation, you gain insight into emptiness within the calm abiding and vipassana. And then you see the emptiness directly, which is the path of seeing. And still further, you go into the path of meditation, acquainting yourself more with the experience that you have already gained. And then you go through the Bodhisattva grounds. As you progress along the path, you actually develop the paths which go against the subtler and subtler forms of negative emotions and the other clinging. And then when you are able to overcome all the defilements within your mind stream, you reach Buddhahood. And so from this time, we need to aspire to reach the path of accumulation first. As ordinary beings now, we need first to enter the path of accumulation, then part of preparation, which is referred by Gati, the first Gati, and then the second Gati refers in the Heart Sutra, the second Gati refers to the part of preparation, and then the Paragati refers to part of seeing, and Parasangati refers to the part of meditation, and then Bodhi refers to full enlightenment. So that's how we should aspire to reach. So what our destination is, as Buddhists, is shown by this mantra of Heart Sutra, Paragati Bodhisvaha. And in the Sanskrit scriptures, there's also mention of the essence of Tathagata, usually called Buddha nature. So, which is the state where you attain the four Buddha bodies, omniscience. So that omniscience is attained on the basis of the mind that we have now. As you get rid of the defilements which cover our minds now, and you become totally free from all these defilements, the coverings, then you become fully enlightened, omniscient one. Verse 38. One who sees how cause and effect are produced and destroyed does not regard the world as really existent or really non-existent. Things are not non-existent because we see causality, but they are not; they do not have any objective existence because they are dependent. Verse number 39. One who has heard thus the doctrine extinguishing all suffering, but does not examine it, and fears the fearless state, trembles due to ignorance. The cause of suffering is afflictive emotions, and the afflictive emotions are rooted in ignorance. So when someone hears that things do not have any objective intrinsic existence, then they fear such teaching, saying that, oh, this is nihilistic view. And when so such teachings saying that there is no intrinsic existence are nihilistic teachings. But when you understand that things do not have any objective existence, then you'll be able to see that these negative emotions can be overcome. And you will have this aspiration, when can I actually reach that goal of full enlightenment, which is free from all these negative emotions and stains in mind? So those who assert, the realists, the true existence in things, that all these will not exist in nirvana, does not frighten you. So they assert nirvana without remainder, in which they say in certain philosophical schools within Buddhism say that just as a fire completely goes out when the fuel is exhausted, likewise when you reach nirvana, this without remainder, nothing is of you is left at all, even the mind. But the Madhyamakas do not say that. Madhyamakas say that do not say that the mind does not go out of existence at all. So why does their non-existence explained here cause you fright? In liberation, there is no self and no aggregates. If liberation is asserted thus, why is the removal of here of the self and of the aggregates not liked by you? Verse number 41. And so, according to the Madhyamaka system, the nirvana without remainder refers to when the state whereby the person is totally absorbed in emptiness, and therefore there is no appearance of independent existence of things at all. All appearances, own experiences, kind of dissolve, as the seventh Dalai Lama says. Whereas when you come out of that kind of absorption in emptiness, total absorption in emptiness, then the appearances and other experiences happen. That is kind of a nirvana where there is a remainder. If nirvana is not non-thing, just how could have thingness? And the extinction of the misconception of things and non-things is called nirvana. So if you just assert that things, only those things that we can actually see with our sensory perception exist, and things which are slightly hidden, which have to be inferred through logic and reasoning, and then also those which have to be taken on the authority of scripture are not there. That's not right. So regarding emptiness, Master Nagarjuna says, that which is dependent on origination is said to be empty. And so it doesn't mean that nothingness. Verse number 43 done. In brief, the view of nihilism is that effects of actions do not exist without merit and leading to the bad state. It is regarded as wrong view. In brief, the view of existence is that effects of actions exist. Meritorious and not conducive to happy transmigrations. It is regarded as a right view. Because existence and non-existence are extinguished by wisdom, there is a passage beyond meritorious and ill deeds. This, say the excellent, is liberation from the bad transmigration and happy transmigration. Seeing production is caused, or one passes beyond non-existence, because you see the causality works there. So the suffering comes ultimately because of ignorance, the fundamental ignorance, and that ignorance is a distorted conception or misconception, and therefore it can be ended and overcome. And the path to do that is there is the path to lead to that, and then you attain through that path the true cessation. And so things do not exist the way they appear to us, as if having some intrinsic existence. And seeing cessation is as caused. One also does not assert existence. So next verse is an analysis of the causes previously produced. If you think about a cause which is objectively existent, then the effect cannot rely on it. So if the cause were to have any intrinsic existence, objective existence, then it cannot be an effect of its own cause which has given rise to it. Therefore, we need to establish things or understand things in terms of how things are dependently originated or relative. And so if things were to have any intrinsic existence, then you cannot talk about causality. So previously produced and simultaneously produced causes are non-caused. Thus, there are no causes in fact, because such production is not confirmed at all as existing conventionally or in reality. When this is that arises, like short when there is long, due to the production of this, that is produced, like light from the production of a flame. When there is long, there is short. They do not exist through their own nature, just as due to the non-production of a flame, light also does not arise. When having thus seen that effects arise from causes, and one asserts what appears in the convention of the world and does not accept nihilism. So this verse number 50 shows how things are conventionally existent. One who asserts, just as it is cessation that does not arise from conventions, does not pass into a view of existence. Thereby, one not relying on duality is liberated. So although one may assert emptiness, but if you are not able to negate the subtle object of negation, then for such people, the teaching on the selfness of the person is taught, and within them and then there are the Chittamatras also, for whom certain emptiness, type of emptiness is shown, and then there is emptiness also taught for the Madhyamakas as well. So even the Madhyamakas who assert some objective existence in things, they say that things do have some objective existence. Things do have some existence from their own side. So the reason they give is they say that there is a valid cognition which is unmistaken in terms of the apprehension or in terms of how there is this appearance of self-defined characteristics of things to the consciousness. And then there is also a difference in saying whether the object of negation when we establish emptiness appears to this sensory perception or not, even amongst the Madhyamakas. So we have great philosophers and thinkers of in the past from in the Nalanda Monastic University. People didn't take the teachings just for granted, but they did a lot of critical analysis into the teaching of the Buddha. And so I usually say that most of these Nalanda masters were from South India. So I say the South Indians have a special brain. But Northern Indian people, because of the colder climate, maybe their brain does not work as well. And as the brain of the southerners, perhaps the southern people from the south have better brain because of coconuts. They could take coconut water and eat coconuts. So, and then there were the non-Buddhist masters who actually challenged the Buddhist masters. Now, if there were no such challenges, then the Buddhist masters would not have made such development.
Remember that.
So you remain complacent without challenge. A form is seen from a distance is seen clearly by those nearby. If a mirage were water, why is water not seen by those nearby? So although things do not have any objective existence, but they appear to be so, and therefore the way this world is seen is as real by those afar is not so by seen by those nearby, for whom it is signless, like a mirage. Just as a mirage is seemingly water, but not water, and does not in fact exist as water, so the aggregates are seemingly a self, but not a self, and do not exist in fact. And verse number 55 and 56 read, and then verse number 57, a follower of non-existence goes to bad transmigration. Now here, what is shown is the nihilists and then those who assert some permanence in things. And a follower of existence goes to happy transmigrations. Through correct and true knowledge, one does not rely on dualism and becomes liberated. So what does that mean is if you are able to assert and understand that things do not exist the way they appear to us intrinsically or independently, nor there is they are non-existent. If through correct and true knowledge such wise persons do not assert existence and non-existence, and thereby you think that they follow non-existence, why should they not be followers of existence? So the Madhyamakas who understand how things really exist or will not say that things have some true existence. And they will not assert non-existence, non-nihilism as well. But because they understand how the exact working of karma, they will assert how things exist conventionally. And so, if from refuting existence, non-existence would accrue them, why from refuting non-existence would existence not accrue to them? So there were many different philosophical systems that existed in India in the past. So verse number 61, as the Sankhyas, the followers of Kanada, Nilgranthas, and the worldly proponents of the person aggregates, whether they propound what passes beyond is and is not, thereby know that the ambrosia of the Buddha's teaching is called profound, an exclusive doctrine passing far beyond is and is not. How could the world exist in fact? With a nature passed beyond the three times, not going when disintegrating, not coming and not staying even for an instant, because the coming, going and staying of the world in Nirvana do not exist as their own reality, what difference is there, in fact, between the two? So, verse number 56 and these verses may be reference to refuting the Vaibhashikas. And then verse number 66. If always changing, how are things non-momentary? If not changing, how can they be altered, in fact? And then verse next verse may be the refutation of the Vaibhashikas. So verse number 69 or 70, verse 71. So due to having many parts, there is no unity. So we can talk about parts and a whole and its parts, and one and many and so forth. But they are not asserted or posited with the view that they have some called intrinsic inherent existence. Further, without one, there is not many. So, if it is thought that through disintegration or an antidote, an existent becomes non-existent, then how without an existent could there be a disintegration or an antidote? Hence, in fact, there is no disappearance of the world. Then verse number 74 down shows the great silence of the Buddha. Thus the doctrine of definite goodness, because he did not teach this profound doctrine to worldly beings who are not receptacles, then all knowing is therefore known by the wise to be omniscient. So without understanding that things do not have any true independent existence, what one would do is, because one has not actually been able to destroy one's own undermine one's own clinging to that kind of existence, one will also may lead others to cling to such an existence as well. So frightened by this baseless doctrine, delighting in a base, not passing beyond existence, non-existent, unintelligent beings ruin themselves. Afraid of the fearless abode, ruined, they ruin others. O King, act in such a way that the ruined do not ruin you. O King, lest you be ruined, I will explain through the scriptures the mode of the supramundane, just as it is, the reality not partaking of dualism. So verse number 80 down teaches the selflessness of persons. A person is not earth, not water, not wind, not space, not consciousness, and not all of them. What else is a person then? So when you have a sense of an eye, it happens on the basis of having a sense of your aggregates, a body and a mind, or the mind. So on the basis of these aggregates, you will talk about, I'm old, I'm young. And also, we call people different names, Tai Chi or Penzo and so forth, on the, based on the appearance of the aggregates. So, just as since we have the sense of an eye based on the aggregates, so the person is there's nothing that can that you can posit the person to be within the earth element in the person, nor the water, nor the fire, nor not fire, nor space. But when it comes to consciousness, the Chittamatras say the Alaya Vijana is the entity or the identity of the person. They posit eight different consciousnesses. And one of them is this Alaya Vijana, which is the instance of the identity of a person. And then Master Bhav Viveka says that I assert that this consciousness, this is the sixth consciousness, to be the identity of the person. Of course, we do assert the continuity of a person on the basis of the continuity of the consciousness. But within the consciousness, if you check what is the person, the present or the past or the future, nothing can be posited as a person. And on the one hand, the consciousness itself is the appropriated aggregate. And how can you actually say that the appropriated is the appropriator as such? And then the collection of the six these elements, the six elements, cannot be posited as a person as well. But nor can you say there is a apart from these six elements, there is a separate person separately. So what person is there other than these? So this shows how you cannot find a person when you do this kind of analysis. But does it mean that the person does not exist? No. The person exists by way of designation. Just as a person is not real due to being a composite of six constituents, so is the constituent. So there is a person who experiences pain and pleasure, which are the results of our good or bad karmas. Although a person is there, you cannot find the person from amongst the five aggregates. In this 22nd chapter of Mula Madhyamaka Karika, which is the analysis of the Tathagata, I usually switch this to oneself. I mean, applying to oneself, I'm neither the aggregates nor am I the aggregates me. I'm not in the aggregates nor the aggregates on me. What else? What then is me? And so when you do the tantric practices, you actually dissolve yourself into an emptiness, and then from within these clear-light minds, which has emptiness as its object, and from within this meditation on emptiness, you arise into a deity. And when you do a Dehi Yoga practice, when you do this Dehi Yoga practice in this way, then it makes real sense. You can get some taste of the Dehi Yoga practice as such. And so you need to make your mind familiar with this kind of meditation, and without really paying much attention to it, then it would be, even the tantras would not be so meaningful, the practice, as Shantideva says. Without understanding the teaching of Tantra, if you do your daily yoga practice, there is always the risk of grasping at a deity which is independently existing, and then you may arise into a very fearful deity. So that is actually undermining the practice of Dharma through Tantra. So around 40 years ago, I have appealed to our community that those monasteries and nunneries which traditionally did not have any study of philosophy should engage in this, take up the study of philosophy, and so even nunneries. And therefore, today, after 40 years, we have today nuns who are going to complete their study of Geshe program. So we are now about to have Geshe Mass, the female Geshes. So the Buddha gave both male and men and women the full ordination of bhikshus and bhikshunis. So, therefore, we need to do our best in terms of practice of the Dharma and study. So, whereas in the case of the Vinaya, of course, we need to follow the tradition. So, in the case of the Mula Sarvastivada tradition, which the Tibetan Buddhists follow, for the female bhikshuni ordination, the ordination master, the precept master, should be a bhikshuni, and although in Tibet there were few bhikshunis, but those bhikshunis were not ordained without flaws in the ordination procedure. And so in the Chinese tradition, you still have the bhikshuni ordination. So we need to also know the procedure of giving bhikshuni ordination according to the scriptures. And so with this, regarding bhikshuni ordination in the Tibetan society, we cannot do much because of following the... some people say that I, as the Dalai Lama, can actually do something about this, but there's nothing I can do about this since we need to follow the Vinaya tradition. So during the time of the Buddha, of course, people became ordained as soon as the Buddha said, "Come here." So these are called the ordination, receiving ordination with the uttering the word, the phrase, or a statement, "Come here." And then the Buddha himself became ordained by himself, not receiving ordination from someone else. So we have a practice of ordaining people by a sangha of 5 or 10. And we cannot talk about having visions and give ordination to other people, saying that, "Oh, I have such and such vision, therefore I can give this ordination." That's not going to work in the Vinaya tradition. So I once knew one Japanese practitioner. He built many stupas, peace pagodas, I think, around the world. So I asked him about his lineage, and he told me this what he was doing was his own tradition, and he didn't have any lineage as such. He said, "It's my own tradition." So this is as almost like self-ordination of the Buddha. Do not cause decline through Tantra and Sutra, as Shantideva says in his Bodhisattva Charya Avatara. We need to be careful in our practice of the Dharma. If you are practicing according to the Sutra, you need to study the Sutras. Without knowledge, you cannot do practice of just by sitting still. And similarly, in the case of Tantra, you cannot do practice without understanding, without knowledge. In the case of Tantra, we have the term Vajradhara, what Vajra means, which means the indivisibility of wisdom and method. And in the Rigveda Samaja, there are the four types of Vajradhara. General meaning, the literal word, meaning of the word, the implicit or the hidden meaning, and then the ultimate meaning of Vajra. And then the Tantras also need to be understood through the four doors and the six means. In the case of this clear, explicit Tantra like Kala Chakra, perhaps these means are not needed. So just as a person is not real due to being composite of six constituents, so each of the constituents also is not real due to being a composite. 81.
Regarding the five elements, here the text is referring to not to the five elements, but the causes of the five elements. So it's sort of more or less referring to the potential that leads to the arisal of the five elements, which is not really substantial. Potential and designation imputed. So assembly means a collection of parts. If there is no assembly, without parts, there is no collection. Without a collection, there is no parts. So we are on stanza 84. He's reading through the verses right now.
91.
Stanza 91. in the Heart Sutra, where it is said that like five organs, five sex sense organs, are absent. So the meaning is same. Stanza 93, earth, water, fire, and wind, long and short, subtle and coarse, as well as virtues also, to be seized in the consciousness. That means the last line. Conventionally, phenomena appear in their different aspects, but when you analyze in their ultimate sense, the lack of inherent nature, at that level, all phenomena are equal, same. So, all elaborations sort of dissolve at the level of emptiness. So that's what this is saying. To be seized in the consciousness. Stanza 94. Earth, water, fire, and wind do not have a chance. In the face of that undemonstrable consciousness, complete large over the limitless, stands the 95, here long and short, subtle and coarse, virtue and non-virtue. And here names and forms, all are ceased. In the Madhyamika Mulakarika homage verse also says that dependent origination, the eight aspects of dependent origination are empty, or rather absent, in the view of the cognition that sees emptiness. Stanza 96. Ninety-seven. All these phenomena of beings are seen as fuel for the fire of consciousness. Blah blah. So here is a point when the object, when you analyze, cannot be found. Similarly, the emptiness itself, which is the unfindability of the object, is also unfindable. So all phenomena subsumes into emptiness. But if you analyze the emptiness that is in all phenomena, that is itself unfindable. So therefore we say emptiness of emptiness. Standard 99, because the phenomenal forms are only names, space too is only a name. Without the elements, how could form exist? Therefore, even name only does not exist. Regarding this last line, therefore, even name only does not exist. Without the elements, how could forms? Form is just a mere name. The absence of form, which is the absence itself, is also just a mere name. So the formless, the space-like formless realm, is also a name, a mere name. And the mere name, also a mere name, lacks inherent nature. So here, this is the object of discussion here is on form. Next, it says feelings, discriminations, compositional factors, and consciousnesses are all to be considered like the elements and the self, thereby the six constituents of selfless. So, the first chapter of the Precious Garland has finished. So, this is a very, very comprehensive text and very good for beginners, whether monk or ordained or non-ordained, not ordained. If you want to be a good person, a virtuous person, an honorable person, these practices we should implement, and that will help us. Next is the middling stage of meditation by Acharya Kamalashila. Kasan, this go to Sarva. Go this to Mare. So, the nature of phenomena is regarding that first phenomena is subject to change due to cause and condition. This is, for example, getting a good job, getting a good pay, salary, and attaining good reputation. If you want to attain such goals, at the time in your childhood, shouldn't have to go to school, sent to be a school, and they should study well and work hard. So that's the method, the cause. And that cause will help in the future to get a good life and also be a constructive person in the future for society. So similarly, building a house, just building a good house is not enough. It should have good furniture. Similarly, a bird's making a nest. Just building a nest is not enough. And the bird should lay eggs, which is also part of the reason why the nest was built. So everything comes from causes and conditions. This is something apparent to our eyes. So therefore, when the Buddha teaches, he teaches on the basis of changing the condition causes and conditions. So changing, shaping the causes and conditions in such a way that good results will occur in the future. So in the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, first the Buddha taught the four Noble Truths and the six aspects, the first four sets of the six aspects are regarding the nature of the suffering, and the second four sets are about the cause. So if you engage in those practices, what is the benefit? If you say, suffering should be understood, and when suffering is abandoned, what is there to be understood? When the cause is already abandoned, what is there to be abandoned? So the Four Noble Truths itself has in the Four Noble Truths, the Buddha first the Buddha explained the causes and conditions, and then the practice what should be practiced, what should be abandoned, and then what can be achieved, the cause, the result. So there is a cause and result stage within the Four Noble Truths. And also the causes and conditions should not should be a complete set of causes and conditions. So, and regarding the resultant enlightenment, regarding the enlightened resultant enlightenment stage, it also depends on, arise from causes and conditions. There is no inherent enlightenment, which is permanent, singular and causeless. So what are the causes of the state of enlightenment? Compassion and the bodhicitta, moved by compassion, and the six perfections motivated by bodhicitta mind. So compassion, bodhicitta and a method, which refers to the six perfections. Nagarjuna has, at the end of this precious garland, has said that which says, if you want to attain enlightenment, the root or the foundation is bodhicitta, the practice of bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment. That and the state of enlightenment are sort of like indispensable to either. If there is no practice of bodhicitta mind, there is no enlightenment. Without that, if you have that, then enlightenment will occur. So this is the, referring to the relation between cause and effect. There are two, regarding the relations between two objects, there are two kinds. One is the relation of causality and one is the relation of same nature. So so that last line in the precious garland says, the foundation is bodhicitta. But that bodhicitta is also dependent on the all-pervasive compassion. Bodhicitta has, the bodhicitta mind has two aspects. It it sort of objectifies sentient beings, and it, its wisdom aspect sort of targets the state of enlightenment. So the word bodhi, the bodhi, which means sort of completely purify all defects and defilements, which in Tibetan word changchub, the first refers to purification, and the second syllable chub refers to attainment of all good knowledges and good qualities. So to attain the state of enlightenment, one needs bodhicitta, which is supported by compassion, and that too is ultimately dependent sort of on this the perfect view of emptiness, free from the two extremes. So here, this text here, sort of places compassion.
If you ask what are the causes
process.
So how to practice compassion? His Holiness says he will perhaps not just read through the text word by word. Will just mainly explain the meanings and occasionally go over the words. So compassion is a mind which sort of thinks of all sentient beings and wishes, earnestly wishes to free the sentient beings from their respective sufferings. That's the definition of compassion. Now, when compassion is associated with the view of emptiness, then it has a different shade of meaning. This root of, because the root of the emptiness mind perceives that the root of samsara and suffering is ignorance, and that leads to suffering and samsara. So, for example, if there is a river and a person is being washed away, swept away by the water, an onlooker who sees that situation cannot help much because it's a very big river, and just feels sympathy. But if the onlooker thinks, if I make an effort, jump into the river and try to save that person, and together we can cross the river or that water and get to the other side. Just like I said earlier, previously, compassion is such that, for example, it comes. You have to practice it to those people around you. It's sort of an empathy, and then expand it towards all sentient beings, all human beings. For example, there are some people in this world who are very, very selfless and thinks of innumerable people on this earth, how to help them, like that. Now, if that is associated with the view of emptiness, the person will not only think how to help sentient beings, but they will think how to, you know, even eliminate their root of suffering, the very seed and the cause of their suffering. So there's a different, so the meaning becomes, the perspective becomes slightly different. And regarding bodhisattvas, there are two types, the intelligent and not so intelligent. Those who are not so intelligent bodhisattvas, they just, all they can do is just pray and wish, aspire that for the sake of all sentient beings, may I attain Buddhahood. Whereas those who are intelligent, the intelligent bodhisattvas, they first understand themselves whether it is possible to attain the state of Buddhahood, and then also whether it is possible to attain Buddhahood for sentient beings. And then if they realize that on the basis of this consciousness that is within us, it is possible to attain enlightenment through practicing antidote to overcome the root of samsara. And similarly, for the sake of all sentient beings, when that happens, an enormous force of compassion arises in you for all sentient beings, an unbearable sense of empathy, compassion. So compassion has has these two aspects. First of all, the wish to free them from suffering, from their respective sufferings, and the other is this sort of feeling of tenderness, sort of love, loving kindness towards sentient beings. So there are two. It has compassion has two aspects. So first, you think about the nature of suffering. As long as one is in samsara, there is no. We are all subject to suffering and subject to the force of delusion and karma. So, to be able to get a huge good comprehension of this, first you think about this aspect on yourself. That as long as I'm myself in samsara, there's no I'm subject to suffering. So this is called the feeling of renunciation, feeling of aversion to samsara. Samsaric existence, and then apply it to other sentient beings. So now so there are two systems of developing this. The seven step, the seven cause and effects step to practice bodhicitta and also compassion, and practicing bodhicitta through developing bodhicitta through the method of equalizing and exchanging oneself on others. So first of all, in order to do that, this practice should be preceded by the practice of equalizing, because we have attachment to some sentient beings and detachment to some other sentient beings. So we have to cut that attachment. Because no matter how much compassion we practice, if we have this feeling of sort of being closer to some and distant to others, that is an obstacle to the practice of compassion. So you have to cut that attachment and equalize all sentient beings as being same. So this text here first starts with the practicing developing bodhicitta through the practice of exchanging, equalizing, exchanging oneself and others. And with regard to that, the greatest text is the Bodhisattva Charya by Shantideva. It's an incredible text for the practice of bodhicitta, and which has 10 chapters. I have received this teaching from Shantideva, and Kunlama Rinpoche told me that since the 10th century until now, regarding the practice of bodhicitta, no teaching or no instruction has been greater than this Bodhisattvacharya text composed by Shantideva. So this text is there in the Korean language and also in the Vietnamese. So so it is very, very it is advisable to all of you to practice, study from time to time, read this text. In the 8th chapter, there's a lot of explanation on meditative concentration, and the 6th chapter is perhaps on the I don't remember well what he sort of said. I think on patience. So the bodhicitta mind is the obstacle to developing bodhicitta is hatred, attachment to some and hatred to others. For that, you have to practice the chapter on patience and tolerance. And in the chapter on meditative concentration, there's an extensive explanation on the equalizing and exchanging one samadhis that until now we have sort of our tendency of thinking is such that we think of ourselves like a king. And so think well, until now I have been relying on this self-cherishing ego, and what has that given us, benefited us? Until now it has been the true source of all kinds of suffering for ourselves. Then in the Madhyama Mula Kariga, the 26th chapter, it explains on the fault of inherent nature. And in the 23rd chapter, where it is said that the three poisons are misconceptions, preconceptions, and they are further caused by the most subtle ignorance of self-grasping. And regarding the 24th chapter, there's extensive explanation on the meaning of emptiness by explaining the nature of dependent origination. And also the meaning of emptiness, the purpose of emptiness, these are all explained in this text. And also this repudiation of those views which claim that the view of emptiness is a nihilist view. So the 24th chapter of the Madhyamika Mula Karika is an extremely important chapter. The whole meaning of the Madhyamika Mula Karika text can be summed up into these two lines. What is not dependent origination? What is dependent origination is empty. What is empty is not independent, something like that. So just by meeting, meeting once together in this hall, once and listening to a teaching alone will not be enough to understand emptiness. You have to go back and review what you have heard. Regarding myself, I can see that I am a fortunate person. I have done many good things in previous lifetimes, but in this lifetime I have also worked very hard. I have studied and practiced very hard, and the hairs on my head gradually disappeared. Not suddenly. So the realization in our mind also is a gradual development. A person doesn't become bald overnight. That's a very bad. That's an ominous sign. So also, if you learn about emptiness today and tomorrow you have realized emptiness, that's an impossible thing, and that's a big joke. So you have to study and research and contemplate on this topic over a long period, and gradually definite and certain that you will undergo change and you will have some realization. So here the text is talking about the seven steps to developing bodhicitta, like this, recognizing all sentient beings as one samadha, remembering their kindness like that. So, and regarding, so, and the text says, the sentient beings of the three realms in the samsara are horn, who are in and who are the subject of suffering, are the three kinds of subject. The subject suffering of suffering, suffering of change, suffering of composition of a factor. So, and then regarding the third suffering, the text says that in the two higher realms, where the beings, the sentient beings in the higher realms, are always in a state of meditation, they don't have the gross sufferings, but since they don't have the antidote to self-grasping ignorance, they are still not yet not free from samsara, and they are bound to sort of fall back into the lower realms, and they are also object of our compassion. And then through the meaning of emptiness, one realizes that enlightenment is possible. And through the practice of compassion, one aspires to attain enlightenment for the sake of sentient beings. According to ancient Indian scholars, different views are there. Some say the compassion, the bodhicitta is a mental factor. According to some others, bodhicitta is a mind. So there's a difference between mind and mental factor. And then bodhicitta, the mind bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment, has also subdivisions, like depending on sort of based on how they are explained, like seen from the point of view of their nature, and so through designation, there's the what is called as the ultimate bodhicitta and conventional bodhicitta. And the view of emptiness, which is an antidote to the obscuration of knowledge. Which is associated with the bodhicitta mind, and which is an antidote, of ignorance. That view of emptiness is the ultimate bodhicitta. So this bodhicitta is a view of emptiness, which sees emptiness directly. There are those whose minds are bound by various fetters of disturbing emotions like craving, desire. Others are in turmoil with different types of wrong views. These are all causes. So the practice of compassion and practice of bodhicitta should be sort of combined or alternate. You should alternate them, and through that combine them, and then gradually one will be able to attain the ultimate bodhicitta, the direct perception of emptiness. So first, the view of emptiness the emptiness wisdom which is based on analytical analysis should be combined in order to transform that into the vipassana meditation. It should be combined with shamatha, the practice of concentration. For example, vipassana is, for example, itself a common practice in both Buddhism and non-Buddhist doctrines. So in order to develop the vipassana of emptiness, it should be preceded by the practice of shamatha practice, the meditative concentration. But that should be that practice should be done for the sake of developing this vipassana of emptiness, not just for the sake of developing shamatha. So therefore, first we will begin this text. Now begins explaining on the practice of shamatha practice or meditative stabilization. During the practice of vipassana and shamatha, or in other words, meditative concentration and especially insight, what are the resources do you need? First of all, one should accumulate merit, like contentment. So before when developing shamatha, if one has developed quite stable meditative concentration, then one it may be okay to stay in a town or in a crowded place or in a city. But otherwise, if you are just a beginner, it is better to seek a solitary place, or rather a more secluded place where there is quiet and peace. Because otherwise, at the beginner's level, just by hearing a sudden sound, one feels alarmed and disturbed. So also like traveling in trains and cars and buses, these are also obstructions. But as one gets more and more familiarity, accustomed to this meditation, and one like sort of it becomes, the situation becomes such that what goes in front, what happens in front of one's eye, one doesn't sort of it doesn't disturb oneself, or whatever one sounds that pass, that sort of pass by one's ear, wouldn't disturb you. That sort of thing, that that level can arise eventually. I'm not saying I have attained shamatha, but shamatha practices is a practice that has to come over sort of a long sort of come through a consistent practice, not immediately. And next is the practice of accumulating merit, like prostrations, making offerings like this. These things one should do before sitting into the meditation, not at the time of meditation or simultaneously with meditation. So the main sort of instrument, tool you need for practicing shamatha is mindfulness and memory. And also, also one should refrain from the 10 non-virtuous actions, and engage, and also from engaging in wrong livelihood. So these one should these are practices of discipline, moral ethics, and so here also one needs the these two tools of mindfulness and introspection, always being mindful of your action and your motivation like that, and introspecting. And then when one actually practice shamatha, you can, as far as the object of meditation is concerned, you can take whatever you you prefer to, like flowers, like off, and etc., which are external things. One can also take internal sort of internal objects. Sometimes so you can also take the breath, the inhale and exhale of one's breath, and just focus the mind on that, like sort of counting that to like about 100 times, and trying to keep your mind focused for that much time. So practice of shamatha doesn't mean that you are sort of you look at an external object like a flower, and then with your open eyes and sort of remain transfixed on that object. That's not the meaning. It's something you remember the aspect of the object, and then keeping the mind focused on that object, sort of staying focused on that object by practicing mindfulness and introspection. And regarding vipassana, special insight, there are two kinds. The transcendental special insight, And the main purpose of practice of Vipassana is to the ultimate bodhicitta, direct perception of emptiness. In order to do that, first you have to understand the meaning of emptiness, because the direct perception of emptiness is a perception of emptiness. So without understanding what emptiness is, you cannot develop that. So one of the prerequisite for developing Vipassana is relying on a qualified master to understand the meaning of emptiness.
So regarding the prerequisites, on page 30, paragraph 3, it says there are the prerequisites to special insight. They are to rely on holy persons, to seek seriously extensive instructions, and to contemplate properly. So, of course, in order to know how to progress along the path and grounds of bodhisattvas, you need to study the Prajaparamita sutras according to the Abhisamaya Alamkara and its commentaries. So if you have these texts in your own languages, then you should study these texts. And if not, then there are people, of course, in different countries and different languages who are translating these texts. So if you're a Buddhist, if you profess to be a Buddhist, then you should at least be someone who is learned in the teaching of the Buddha, at least a small scholar. So there are in Tibet, there used to be lots of people who were illiterate. So someone asked somebody else, do you know how to read? And the person responded, I even can't read, even if you write a huge letter as big as a donkey, as a head. So many Tibetans would say that they are Buddhists, and they do pray to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. But today we need to be 21st century Buddhists by understanding what are the four noble truths that are taught by the Buddha. And as a basis for understanding this, you should also understand what the two truths are. As it is said in Abhisamaya Alamkara by Maitreya, where he teaches what are known as the 10 instructions. Beginning with the teacher saying that you should understand what are the two truths. Which comprise the nature of the path. And then also you should understand the four truths. And then understanding emptiness and your understanding of emptiness and so forth also should be used to develop the altruistic spirit of enlightenment, bodhicitta. And then you should develop these within oneself. So sometimes people become very learned, but then they are not able to integrate those teachings, that the knowledge into their practice. Their only focus is how to debate with others, argue against others, and to defeat others. And therefore, it's very important for us to, having studied the scriptures, to integrate them within oneself. So the Buddha says that the purpose of study is to do meditation. And through the meditation and study, one should liberate oneself from this fortress of or the bondage of samsara. And Je Rinpoche, Tsongkhapa, has also said that in the beginning, I sought much learning. In the middle, I found that all these scriptures, teachings, are my instruction for my spiritual development. In the end, I put effort in practice, in meditation, and I dedicate all the merit to for the flourishing of the Dharma. So when a yogi, the text says that when a yogi engages in his or her practice, he should do it in the beginning moderately and avoid non-vegetarian meals. And so even in the scriptures of the Buddha, there are certain instances where the Buddha actually mentions that one should not eat meat. But in the case of in such cases, he... in the case of Lankaravatara Sutra, the Buddha has actually instructed not to take any kind of meat or flesh of animals. So in Tibet, for example, in the nomadic areas, people had no vegetables that they could grow, and therefore they have to rely on meat or animal flesh for their sustenance. But today, we have vegetables and fruits in abundance, and therefore it's good to take to vegetarian meals as much as possible. But sometimes you have to also take into account your own health. When your health is, when you are not healthy, you should see what's best as well. Even while I was in Tibet, during the official ceremonies and festivals, we always had non-vegetarian meals. And then I changed that custom to give vegetarian meals during such ceremonies. And then after coming into exile in India, I took to vegetarianism for more than a year. I was a vegetarian. And then I suffered jaundice, and my eyes and nails turned yellow. And so later I used to jokingly say that at that time I became a true living Buddha, a yellow body with a yellow body, golden body. So that's not because of I didn't become a living Buddha with a golden body because of meditation, but due to sickness. And then doctors, Tibetan traditional Tibetan doctors as well as allopathic doctors advised me to told me that since I was used to taking meat, they advised me to go back to the original diet. And so these days I take meat two times a week, if meat is available. But in India, all the major monastic institutions have now changed to vegetarian meal. as institutions. And in Tibetan settlements in India, we don't have pig farm or fishery, fish farm or poultry farm. So in the past, there was, in one of the settlements, people had a poultry farm, but then I asked them, if it's not indispensable for you to have the poultry, you could get rid of it. And in fact, when I asked at one time, what do you do when the hens, the chickens get old? And so they had no reply. They were silent. And so they agreed with me not to have poultry farm in the Tibetan settlements. So, of course, not all Tibetans are vegetarian. So the common kitchen in the big monasteries in South India, since they have changed to vegetarianism, people who have set up their restaurants nearby the monasteries who actually sell meat, momos, do good business these days, I heard. So Chinese Buddhists and Vietnamese, they stick to vegetarian meal, which is very good. I really admire you. So once I had a discussion with a Sri Lankan monk regarding vegetarianism and non-vegetarianism. So he told me that as bhikshus, as Buddhist monks, we have to live on alms, begging for our food. And if we go to a family who is non-vegetarian and they give us a non-vegetarian meal, of course we have to take that. And if another family gives us a vegetarian meal, then we have to accept that too. And so he said we are neither vegetarian nor non-vegetarian. And so in Thailand also, the monks go on alms round. When I was in Thailand one time, I also joined the Thai monks. So since we had to walk barefoot, it was really difficult for me because my feet were burning, really. And so one must also be moderate in taking meals. For monks, because we cannot eat after noon, it's very good for health. So for the people who are fat, it would be good to avoid dinner, whether you are a monk or not. So I have friends in the West who are really fat, huge. So in my public talks, I tell them to follow the Buddhist monks' practice of not taking meal after noon. And then when I look at them as I said this, then they also nod with me and agreeing with me. So this text talks about bringing up compassion in your mind and then making prostrations by touching five parts of your body on the ground, the forehead, the two palms, and your two knees, touching them on the ground and making prostration. And when we do prostration, we could stretch, we could do the full body length prostration or this shorter version. When we do prostration, we have to actually we cannot just touch the two forms flat, but we form some kind of a butt with the palms forming a hollow, and then the two thumbs going inside, bent inside. And so this is like a represents a jewel. This jewel, external form of a jewel, represents the Buddha's form body, and then the internal hollowness represents the Dhammakaya. And you touch this, holding your hands in this way, you touch them on your crown, throat, and forehead. And in according to the Goya Samaja, the bringing the two hands together and forming this shape actually represents bringing the wind energies, the 10 root or the primary wind and five primary wind energy and the five secondary wind energies, bring them together when you fold fold your palms together like this. And so in your practice, we also do the seven limb practice, such as prostration, making praise to the Buddhas, and making offerings, and purifying, confession, requesting them not to pass away, requesting them to turn the wheel of Dharma, and then finally dedicating all your merits through these practices for enlightenment. And then with regard to the body posture, what is recommended is the seven postures of Virochana. So the first has to do with the legs, keeping the legs are forming this Vajra posture, which means, which is usually considered, called the lotus posture, with your right feet on your left thigh and right, left feet on your right thigh. And then the hands are, the right hand is on top of the left hand, and then the two thumbs are touching, pointing, forming a triangle, and you hold your hands in this meditation posture at the navel point, and then you straighten your spine, and then don't leave the mouth natural, not open. And not if you don't have teeth, of course, then you need to close your mouth tightly. And the tip of the tongue should touch your upper palate, because when you stay in meditation for a long time, you might, what do you call it, drip drool, yeah. And then when if you the purpose of this is also to avoid getting dry, your throat dry, and then the two lips also touch naturally. And your eyes look down in front of you. During certain special meditations, for example, in the case of the Kalachakra, there is a meditation where your eyes are actually looking upwards to the mid-eyebrow. And then in the Dzogchen practice for Tekchu, the breakthrough meditation, you actually just gaze outwards. But in this kind of meditation here, you look down in front of you. Neither should your eyes be too open nor closed. So your head should slightly bend inwards, not to the point of your chin touching your body completely, but And then your two shoulders are straight, also held straight, so that you actually form leave a space between your arms and the body. And then, regarding your breath, neither should you breathe too strongly nor irregularly, but breathe naturally. Slowly. And then, with regard to the focus or the object that you focus on, there are many different types of things that you can use. Here, in our case, it would be good to use a Buddha's image or statue. So, as we already said, that your eyes should be gazing downwards. For your eyes, your eyes should gaze at a distance of about an arm length, and then the statue of the Buddha should be somewhere at the level of your mid eyebrow. And so, if it's smaller, and if the image is smaller, then it's going to help in focusing your mind better. And then it should also be seen and thought as a heavy object. It will help to stay stable. And then also imagining this image to be bright helps in not getting dullness of mind during meditation, dullness or a mental sinking. So when you have all kinds of called investigative meditation, that is analytical meditation, whereas in the case of Shamatha, the single-pointed concentration practice, you do not have diverse objects, but just one object. So with regard to the object that you use for your meditation, analytical or focusing meditation, there is no difference as to what you choose. But In the case of the focusing meditation, you have a single focus, single object that you focus your mind on. So when you try to develop single-pointed concentration, shamatha, or calm abiding, you also need to show mindfulness and introspection. Mindfulness means not forgetting the object that you have chosen for your focus, introspection is this vigilance, whether checking whether you are actually getting distracted away from the focus, or you are some kind of dullness has fallen on the mind or not. And so, so mental laxity, with laxity in your meditation and falling, and the mind fades rather heavy, and there's some kind of a dimness in the mind, without clarity, whereas the mental excitation actually is a form of distraction, where you are distracted by some sensual objects or pleasures. And so you have to avoid both of these when you try to develop this single-pointed concentration. So when you feel slightly dull or low-spirited in your meditation, you should recognize that it is this mental sinking sort of thing is falling on the mind. And so you should be able to show vigilance and be able to get yourself out of this kind of state of dullness. Or the mental excitation. So if your mind is too low, if you feel too low, then there is the danger of the mental sinking, laxity falling. Whereas if you are too elated, then there is the risk of mental excitation or distraction. So when you are too elated, there is danger or risk of mental excitation. Whereas if your mind is too low, sort of a low caste, there is the risk of the mental laxity or mental sinking falling on the mind. So you should always try to see which one is happening and be able to counter that. So when your mind is becoming dull and mental sinking is happening, then you should raise it up. But when if you raise your mind too high, then or become too elated and joyous, then it could also lead you to astray from the object, causing mental excitation. Then you need to bring it down. And somber. So when your mind is too distracted, then you should make it somber by meditating on suffering nature, impermanent nature of things, and so forth. So in the beginning, you should start with a short duration of meditation, and then as you progress in your meditation, be able to see it longer and longer, then you should extend the time duration for to half hour or 1 hour and so forth. I have meditative friends who could stay in meditation for hours and hours. So this comes through training and as you practice this single-pointed concentration, then you go through the 9 steps of developing shamatha. And at the 9th stage, you are free from both the mental excitation and mental laxity or mental sinking. And because of being able to stay focused without distraction or dullness, the internal elements like the wind element and so forth also become very serviceable. And so the defects of or the faults of the energies that help in meditation also go away. And then you experience what is known as the mental and physical pliancy. And when you're able, through that, when you're able to stay focused, single-pointedly focused on the object that you have chosen, then you have developed the shamatha or calm abiding.
Dan shiro zhuya ji, dan shiro zhuya ji, en
And then, so the text says you should understand that calm abiding is actualized when you enjoy physical and mental pliancy through prolonged familiarity with the meditation, and the mind gains the power to engage in the objects as it chooses. And then next comes developing the insight, penetrative insight or special insight on page 35, actualizing special insights section. Having developed this single-pointed concentration or this shamatha, then the object that you have chosen for your single-pointed concentration, the Buddha image, should be analyzed. So saying that the body or the psychophysical aggregates of a Buddha is not the Buddha, nor the Buddha, the aggregates. And neither the Buddha is in the aggregates, nor the aggregates are in the Buddha. And so what Buddha is there then? So in this way, when you do, when you analyze the Buddha, earlier you had this image of a Buddha that really in front of you. A Buddha is someone who is an object of veneration, worship. But when you do this kind of critical analysis into the nature of the Buddha himself, you cannot find the Buddha either. But that doesn't mean that, although that doesn't mean that the Buddha does not exist as such. But Buddha exists by way of name or designation. So the Buddha exists, and existence could only be two ways. One is objectively existing, independent, objectively existent Buddha. The other one is by way of mere designation. Since the Buddha cannot exist objectively, independently, there is no other way but to say that the Buddha exists by way of designation alone. And therefore, when you understand that, as soon as the Buddha appears in your mind, you should be able to confirm that there is no independently existing Buddha as such. So Kirtup Sangye Ishi has said this song, that you place your mind on the empty nature of the mind. Just as the Buddha appears to your mind, you should be able to confirm that there is no independently existing Buddha. So after So on page 36, turn to page 36, first paragraph, what is suchness or tattu like? It is the nature of all phenomena that ultimately they are empty of self, of persons, and of self, of phenomena. So within the Madhyamaka school of thought in Buddhism, there are those of the Savatantika Madhyamakas and the Prasangikas. The former assert that things have objective existence, whereas the latter says there's no objective existence in anything. And so you should, to study the former sub-school of Madhyamaka, you should study the Bhavivekas, heart of Madhyamaka. And if you go into his lamp of wisdom, Bhavivekas, you'll also find him arguing against Chandrakirti's way interpretation of Mula Madhyamaka Karika. And if you look at Chandrakirti's Prasanapada, clear word, you'll see that Bhav Viveka has objected to, I'm sorry, it was not in Chandrakirti, but Buddha Palita, in his commentary on the commentary of the lamp of wisdom. And Chandrakirti actually stands takes side with Buddha Palita and says what Buddha Bhavaviveka has objected and is actually does not work. And if you look at Prasannapada, then you'll be able to see that it's feasible. Everything is feasible when if you say that things are conventionally existent. So here in this text, it is mentioned that it is the nature of all phenomena that ultimately, that the word ultimate is used here. So in order to understand the interpretation of emptiness thoroughly, you have to study these different texts by different masters following different schools. So what you have to understand is as long as there's something left for you to actually grasp or to objectify, I mean, the clinging to some independent existence of things is still left there. And so this should be destroyed completely, and therefore you cannot accept anything to have any objective existence. So in the study of logic and philosophy, we learn about how our mind engages with objects through the principle of elimination or exclusion or not, and what kind of things or phenomena are there, whether there are positive phenomena or negative ones in the sense of implicating negative or non-implicating negative phenomena and so forth. So although there are diverse things, phenomena are diverse, but then they all are one in sense of in the realm of emptiness, and therefore we can understand that within this diversity, everything is of one taste in emptiness, and within that one taste of emptiness, there is the diversity of things as well, and therefore what we are rejecting is not the things themselves as such, but we are rejecting that the independent objective existence of things. And so from the point of view of lacking any intrinsic or independent objective existence, then the persons and other phenomena, the aggregates and so forth, the emptiness or self-consciousness of these two have no degree of subtlety at all. They are So I am now 81. I still consider myself as a student of Buddhism and still study and read texts. And so my younger brothers and sisters and older brothers and sisters, you should also study the texts. So while studying, you may fall asleep, and then your head may be touching the scriptures. But in any case, you should study the text. Work hard. So that is about meditating on the ultimate nature of things. Developing vipassana. And then, on the basis of this meditation on emptiness, vipassana, you'll again develop the pliancy of mind. And then there are four mental engagements or different attentions that are mentioned in the text. You can use them in relation to the ultimate meditation on the ultimate nature of things. So with regards to developing penetrative insight, I mean, you can have a mundane kind of practices, meditation, as well as transcendental meditation as well. And so Bhava Viveka who, and also Master Chandrakshita and his disciples, in their writings, they have not rejected any objective existence in things. So according to the Sakya tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, Madhyamaka, sub-school of Madhyamaka, which started with Chandrakshita, the Yogacara Savatantrika Madhyamakas are called higher Yogacara Savatantrika school, whereas the sub-school of the Madhyamaka called Sotantrika Savatantrika Madhyamakas, started by Bhavivika, is called the lower Savatantrika school of Madhyamaka. Philosophy. And then all these schools do say that there is a valid cognition of things, which says that a cognition which is not mistaken with regard to the object it perceives or whereas the Savatantrika Madhyamakas, the followers of Bhaviveka and Chandrakshita, do accept some objective existence, and then they also say that the object, when you establish or prove the emptiness or selflessness, the object of what you refute or do not appear to the perceptions, sensory perception, whereas the Prasangikas see that they do appear to the perception. The object of negation does appear to the perception, sensory perception. So when you actually break the things, external things, down to their smaller parts, there is the system of Chittamatras who say that things do not exist externally by doing that kind of analysis. And so how do the things exist, if you ask? They say, the Chittamatras say that they exist as a reflection of the imprints of those things on your mind. And therefore the object that you see and the perception which sees it are of one substance, of the same substance, although the objects are not said to be the consciousness or the cognition which sees them. The Chittamatras say that the perceptions and our mind are truly existing phenomena. And in this text, also we'll also find later that things are empty of true existence. If you break it down to its smaller moments, there is nothing truly existing. And so the philosophical view that is propounded here is of Madhyamaka philosophy. So according to the Madhyamakas, who reject any kind of objective existence in things, say that things have no existence from their own side, but they are merely designated by name and conception. So therefore, there's no need to say for them that things have no external existence, but the mind exists truly, and so they can say that things have external existence, but they are merely designated, just as the external objects do not have any objective existence, independent existence. Likewise, the mind itself lacks that kind of existence. So we'll stop here for today. So we'll continue this text, the remaining part of the stages of meditation. And then how to go about with the practice, I'll introduce that on the based on the 37 practices of Bodhisattvas. So which also shows how to cultivate bodhicitta, this spirit of enlightenment. And then we'll also do bodhicitta ceremony for generating bodhicitta. And then we'll stop.
It comes together,
Tambaji, ne? 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 Tambaji, ne?